Okay, so I'm going to speak a little bit more about the crisis or the moment that we're in. We're living in a time in which we've got a major infectious disease outbreak threatening wide segments of the population all over the world. And it's kind of the first time that we've had to deal with an infectious disease outbreak on this scale. That's affected so many people in different locations since the birth of neoliberalism, which we've been living under for a few decades now. And it throws into sharp relief issues around capitalism and inequality, patriarchy, the crisis of care, social reproduction, issues around racism, xenophobia, nationalism, migration and border control, the results of a hollowed out state public health infrastructure, all these things that like those of us who are on the left have been tackling in various forms and are probably used to talking about. These are all coming to the fore in a really sort of stark way in this current moment. So the question is how we can use this moment, what's happening right now, to examine the nature of this broader crisis of state and capital in which all these issues, patriarchy, inequality, racism, are interlinked, like how we can examine these issues with greater clarity, but also how can we use this moment to really imagine and put into action another form of politics and another way of organizing our society, because this moment comes with a risk. Crisis often legitimates further destruction of welfare and support systems by those in power. We see unemployment, we see privatization of public assets and commons. We see those administering the crisis using it as an excuse to kind of impose measures of security and surveillance, a moment where people might be less critical of those things due to arguments around welfare and well-being and safety and such like. This moment comes with risks, and in asking ourselves kind of how to use it to build and practice this other form of politics, we have some big questions that we need to tackle around, like, what is required what is required of our movement for building infrastructure to support the lasting social relationships that will enable us to struggle and truly change society? How can we build power, build social networks and institutions in the middle of this ongoing crisis? And kind of the vulnerability that comes with a crisis kind of opens up these other struggles in which we are also used to fighting around social rights, resources, survival, a huge amount around the politics of care and reproduction, around space where we live, production and distribution of food, resources. So all these big questions about infrastructure and building collective power are ones that we need to tackle. And I said at the very beginning that there's this idea underpinning the ideology of the Kurdish Freedom Movement that it shares with a lot of other movements around the world and throughout history, that the task we have is to build the new world in the shell of the old. And there are other movements that that practice these ideas and have been grappling with these big questions and experimenting with trying to answer them in Mexico, in Chiapas, the struggle of the Zapatistas, which has been ongoing for decades. But we can also look back to history. Hundreds of years ago, there were six nations of Turtle Islanders who together formed a constitution called the Great Law of Peace in 1124. And this was built upon practices between these different groups of Native American peoples that factored in reciprocity and equality, certain like freedom, deliberation, consensus building processes, all these systems that last until today. So it's not just movements that have been around for a few decades. There are peoples that have been trying to organize in very complex ways across ethnicities and borders for hundreds of years. So there are plenty of examples that we can look to. But like I said, today we're going to really focus on the Kurdish freedom movement. So I will hand over to Nick and Bian, who will talk a lot more in a lot more detail about what we can learn from the struggle over there. And just to clarify for anyone that is wondering, the recording we will probably post on the Facebook page, but we'll also post an email address for people to be able to get in touch with us. So one of us will put that in the chat just in case anyone has to duck out early. So now I need to unmute Nick. Apologies for the slight clumsiness. I'm a little bit new to this. Okay.
Great.
Cool.
Thanks, Katie. And it's really great to see so many people participating in this meeting, and for us to show that it's possible to organise at these distances, and to see there's a friend joining us all the way from Bulgaria as well as all across the island that we're organising in Britain. So that's really, really great. My name's Nick. I'm a solidarity organiser with the Kurdish freedom movement in the UK, and also a political organizer in other struggles. And I'm based in London, so I organize mainly with London Kurdistan Solidarity. What I'll talk about in my little presentation here, which like Katie's will be around 10 minutes, maybe a bit more, is the first of these big takeaways that we want people to have from this meeting. So there's, like Katie mentioned, and this first sort of headline or takeaway is that democratic confederalism isn't just a technical structure. It's a way of embodying a culture and a democratic society. And this means that it has a worldview that comes along with it. And if we imagine democratic confederalism as an opposing structure to the nation state and the interstate system, then this definition, I think, can become a bit clearer. We all know that the state and the state system, the nation state, isn't just a technical structure. It's not just a technical organization of institutions. It also has ideologies that come along with it, and it tries to create a worldview so that the people who it claims spontaneously almost reproduce the state in their own minds, in their own mentalities, in their own worldviews. Just like the nation state needs nationalism as its culture in order to be able to organize itself, democratic confederalism needs a democratic society, needs a democratic culture. And I think this is particularly important for us in the global north to understand. The Kurdish freedom movement refers to its own politics, to its theory and practice, as the new paradigm. It doesn't refer to it so much as democratic confederalism. Democratic confederalism is a part of the new paradigm. This is a development from what was called the old paradigm. So the old paradigm was the ideology that the movement began with emerging out of the new left in Turkey in the 70s, and was Marxism-Leninism, as this had been developed, particularly off the back of the Maoist experience, and then as it was developed in Turkey. And in this old paradigm, the point was that Marxism-Leninism was going to be the way in which the Kurdish people were liberated and socialism was established. And by socialism, we can just say that just refers to a free and equal life, a life, a communal life where everyone can develop together without classes, without domination, without exploitation. So if we think of it that way, then the new paradigm is the new way in which that same aim is going to be achieved. It's the new paradigm for how we can achieve the liberation of the Kurdish people as part of a broader establishment of a free life for everyone, everywhere. And that's an important point to emphasize. The Kurdish freedom movement was internationalist and had people who weren't Kurds participating in key figures within it all the way from the beginning. But previously, self-determination, the self-determination of the Kurdish people, the way in which they would liberate themselves, was understood as necessarily passing through a nation state based on state socialist principles. And democratic confederalism then is the way in which this, the new structure beyond the nation state, is going to be is being established based on a rigorous process of criticism within the movement of what a nation state actually did, the extent to which it really liberated anyone, and an assertion that no state actually can provide the framework for liberation, that a state is always necessarily an oppressive structure. And I think it's really important that us in the Global North understand this, because there's a danger that being in the Global North, being in the beating hearts of capitalism and capitalist modernity and the birthplaces of the nation state system, it's very easy for us to fall back on a technical understanding of democratic confederalism, which looks at the structures in Rojava and looks at maybe a diagram of the commune system or the cooperatives as they existed in Bakur in North Kurdistan, in Southeast Turkey, and just sees those as a kind of blueprint. That what we need to do is to look at those structures, to look at how the communes are organized, to look at their technical features as they're done on the ground in Rojava, and just try to reproduce them in our own context. But the key thing here is that it's not those structures on the ground in Rojava that make the system revolutionary. There are lots of contradictions in those systems, which Vian will be able to talk more about. They don't look exactly the same even within Rojava. They vary from place to place, depending on the particular locale. What makes the system revolutionary is the democratic people and the democratic culture that's being built. And that's a key argument of the movement. You won't be able to have democratic confederalism unless you have people who can really be democrats. And by democrat, I don't just mean, or in fact, I especially don't mean democrats in the sense of liberal democracy, where every few years we vote for people who are then empowered to have ultimate power over us. This idea that democracy means just accepting majoritarian rule constantly. No, democracy in this understanding, a democratic society, is a society that's able to take on the tasks of governing in themselves, able to take on the tasks of self-administration. And as part of this, democratic confederalism isn't the only key term there, actually. Democratic autonomy is the way in which self-determination is reconceptualized rather than democratic confederalism. Now, I think it's important that we don't get into a technical or academic discussion about terms, so that I'm not looking to sort of get buried in a terminological debate. But it is important to remember, from our perspectives in the Global North, that there are more terms than just democratic confederalism that are essential to this paradigm. The third in this triad is democratic nation. And democratic nation is an understanding of a society which isn't like the nation state, which is the opposite to the nation state, where the nation state wants every individual to have a homogenous identity. You must have only one ethnic or national identity, one flag, one religion, one people that matches up to the one state. Democratic nation is an expression of imagined collective community that accepts that all of us have multiple identities. So these three terms, democratic confederalism, democratic autonomy, and democratic nation, are all interlinked to each other and all express what it means to build a democratic society. And a key part of this perspective, as Katie alluded to with the example from the Turtle Islanders, is that this isn't something that we're starting from zero in order to achieve. There are democratic ethics already existing in our society. There are democratic ethics that are there that are often unconscious, sometimes very self-consciously anti-political because of how we understand politics, whether they're community organizations or whether they're more local communities that haven't been decimated as much by capitalism in the state. But in the way in which they work, in their sort of innate solidarities with each other, that is a democratic culture. The challenge then is making that democratic culture self-conscious, developing it further, having education and having processes of criticism and self-criticism to extract all of ourselves from the statist mentalities and increase all of our capacities to really be democrats and really self-organize. And what this means then is that democratic confederalism is necessarily going to look very different from place to place. Like I already mentioned, within Rojavrit, it varies from place to place. But very often you'll hear arguments from politicized people saying, well, it's all very good what they're doing in Rojava, and that's great, but the situation's very different here, so it would have to look very different here. And yes, exactly. That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point and the challenge, is that we have to do the work of looking at the organizations that exist here, looking at what civil society looks like, looking at where the gaps are that the state and capital aren't providing all of our needs, and starting to fill those, and starting to build a democratic society in our own area. And in terms of then how we might want to build movements for this society, it also requires a certain change in mindset in terms of what it means to try and build change. Because both electoral politics and lots of species of radical politics, extra-parliamentary politics, politics beyond the state, both have a kind of assumption that what the purpose is to convince people of your position, and then they can join into your organization, and together you're going to collectively change the world. And that's a very obvious point for electoral politics, for parliamentary politics. The idea is that you have people who are voting for your party, who are maybe joining your party organizations or organizations that are connected to it, and that together you'll be able to establish a system of governance, which means that you can create a new world. Or on the other hand, you have more anarchist perspectives, more typically at least anarchist perspectives, that say, well, this is obviously the wrong way to go about it. We don't want one organization, but we still want people to accept our principles and our dogmas, our doctrines. So never ever voting in any way whatsoever, never ever having any kind of institution that's making capital and therefore has some contradictions with the broader capitalist system, but is somehow funneling into struggle. No, that's still not the way in which we should be doing it. We should be building uniformly anarchist movements which can then create self-organization. The Kurdish Freedom Movement's criticism of both these perspectives is that on the one hand, what the electoral forces or more traditional socialist forces are trying to do is to bind the people to themselves in order to create a new state, which is going to create the same forms of oppression as before. And on the other hand, with the anarchists, this means necessarily that you're not going to be able to be organizing as part of all of society, because potentially you get to a point, or the aim is to get to a point, where everyone is extricating themselves in that way from the system, where people are refusing the system that way. But it means it's impossible to meet people where they are and to start organizing with people where they actually are. So the Kurdish Freedom Movement's perspective then, and the way in which you start building a movement for a democratic society, is to shift the point of view. So rather than placing yourself in the center of it, and you want to convince people of your positions and then bring them along with you, what you need to do is view yourself as the initiator of connections between groups that are trying to self-organize themselves and confederate between each other. And this is really important, because it means that you're acting as a guide, but you can't come to that organization or to those people with a view of what it's going to look like in the end. You have to start the process, and you have your democratic principles and you have your democratic ethics, but what that particular self-organization is going to look like, whether it's working class communities in London, or whether it's students on campuses, or whether it's women of color organizing autonomously, the exact form that these are going to take is going to have to vary, and you can't come with a prescription of what that looks like. You need to give people the tools and help people become conscious of the ways in which they're already democratically organizing, and also critical of the ways in which they're reproducing state mentalities and hegemonic worldviews, the worldviews of patriarchy, the worldviews of capital, in their organizing. And I think, just to end then on what I think is somehow the starkest or clearest example of why democratic confederalism, or a movement for democratic confederalism, can't be understood as sort of inherent in the structures, is if we take a look at Switzerland. Switzerland's a really interesting example, because it begins out of mountain communities, organic societies, that are rejecting lots of aspects of state civilizations that existed at that time in late medieval, early modern Europe. And they're setting themselves up in very horizontalist structures. There's lots of direct democracy, there's confederation between autonomous cantons. And so it's really, in its early instances, a very strong example of the argument that democratic civilization exists, has always existed, and has provided this wellspring of resistance to hegemonic civilization. But if we look at Switzerland now, and the way in which the Swiss Confederation works now, it's very clear that it's been fully co-opted into the system. In fact, it's one of the system's pillars in terms of financial capitalism. So there we can see that, regardless of these structures, if the worldview isn't there, if the education isn't there, if the consistent emphasis on the need for criticism, self-education, and movement and development in creating a democratic society isn't there, then the confederal structures are more or less meaningless. So I'll finish there and hand over to Vian, who will talk more about the process of this. And then maybe in the discussion, we can return to some of these points, thinking about the organizing that's going on in mutual aid groups and things like that. So thank you.
Thanks, Nick, and thanks, Katie, for kicking off. So my name is Vian. I was in Rojava for a year, and I just got back a few weeks ago, just in time to, you know, get sick and then get stuck in lockdown. So I'm very happy to be here to be able to share some of my experiences in Rojava working with the Kurdish Freedom Movement. And my political background is largely ecological organizing, feminist organizing, and anti-fascist organizing within often an anarchist perspective. So that was sort of my political background. And I eventually moved away from that in some ways over the years in order to embrace a bit more of like a community organizing grassroots perspective, because I was starting to see the weaknesses of the political perspective, which really tries to kind of make a sort of us against the world out of a very small group of people. And I think, you know, in my heart, like I'm still very driven by an anarchist perspective, but in terms of the practice, I saw a lot of shortcomings, and I was curious to see what the Kurdish freedom movement and Rojava, which is often spoken about both as an anarchist project or as a socialist project, like what it actually looks like on the ground. So I'll try to bring in as many examples and descriptions as possible in order to kind of paint this picture of what democratic and federalism is in Rojava, how messy it gets, and how we work our ways through those contradictions that it raises. So democratic and federalism, as Katie mentioned, isn't just something that's happened in Rojava, but it has a sort of central organizational paradigm. It's a really interesting space to look at how it's developed, because it's in many ways is quite developed, and it's a huge space, right? It's about a population of roughly up to 5 million, although it's unclear because it's such a tumultuous region. So it's a lot of people who are involved in this project, and so it needs to be organized both across this whole region of 5 million people, and then that gets built up from local structures called communes. So just to give a very rough idea of what that looks like, for your commune, which will be anywhere from a few hundred to 1,000 people who you all live nearby, if you wanted to you know, do a tree planting project in sort of the river area of your city, or if you wanted to organize some kind of event or education or startup, a cooperative, things like that, that you would take it first to your local commune. And then if your commune, which is made up of all of you, it's a sort of basic building block of direct democracy, if they say, okay, this is a great idea, but we need to liaise with the other commune next door or with the district or the region, then it kind of gets built up to the federated regions. So for stuff like organizing things which affect a whole city that might be made up of, you know, 50 or 60 communes, like trash delivery, then that gets taken up to the municipal level, and then committees and councils on the municipal level will take on that project. And then you go all the way up to, you know, districts and regions, and then the seven regions come together to create the whole autonomous administration of northern East Syria. So this is kind of the skeleton of democratic and federalism in Rojava, in northern East Syria. It's saying that every day, like there are, our lives are shaped by economy, health, education, and so on, and therefore we have a right to participate in this. So instead of having these leaders who get elected and make all the decisions, it's a very, you know, quite complex system of federation where everybody has a chance to feed in. But there are representatives, there are assemblies, and even though it's far more democratic, it's certainly not that, you know, I could just show up to a region-wide meeting about the economy of the region if I don't have a reason to be there and kind of like have a block, you know, function. So it's not this kind of pure direct democracy that people talk about, but it is also, it's confederalism. It's a very empowering form of organization. And if you want to hear kind of more specific examples and diagrams, everything, I would recommend the Rojava Information Center report, Beyond the Front Lines. If you Google Rojava Information Center, it'll come up, and that has a very, very comprehensive outline of the technical structures of democratic federalism. But to echo what Nick was talking about, it's not just about these technical structures. And even in Rojava, they look different in different areas. So in some areas which are more traditionally governed by tribal structures, those structures have then become enfolded in a democratic federalist system. They haven't set up the same kind of system that you have in, for example, a more Kurdish majority region, which has these quite different kind of traditional neighborhood councils. So it can be quite adaptable to different needs in different regions. Thanks, Nick. So the sort of second headline, the second point that I'd like to talk a little bit about is how this movement for a democratic society, so this kind of culture of democracy, fundamentally has to be very non-dogmatic. It doesn't look the same in different places, as I've just mentioned. And it's also full of contradictions where the different needs of the system are sort of battle each other and you just have to stumble your way through as best as possible. And this is because democratic confederalism and the new paradigm is a vision for all of society, right? It's not just for a group of us. You can't go away and do democratic confederalism away from the rest of society. It's a group project. So for all those people who you disagree with. And it means that you're building something up that you're for. You're not just kind of fighting against something and saying we're against the state or we're against capitalism or against this corporation, but you're fighting for something. You're trying to build something up. And it's something that can happen, that's a constant process. It's something that you can do within existing power structures. It's not something that happens after you get rid of or overthrow the state. It's something you can do within the confines of a state, as the example of Rojava is, and also the example of Bakur in Turkish Kurdistan, where despite there being a very fascist state, a lot of work was done towards building up democratic confederalism to create this status of regional autonomy that's organized along the lines of democratic confederalism. But they're not saying we're going to overthrow the state and that's a primary objective. You actually build up the power of society to the point that either the state becomes irrelevant, which for example in Rojava more or less happened because of the military situation, or that you're able to meet the state in sort of like a confrontation and win. So there's a saying in the movement in Rojava, which is that the struggle for liberation is like picking up rocks and moving them, which is quite apt because it is a lot of hard work, right? And then in order to really like move the stone, you need to put your hand under the stone. So you need to make a lot of effort. You need to fail sometimes. You need to get dirty. And that's the only way that you can understand truth. And so this isn't just like an abstract academic concept. Of course, it's important to have ideas and share them and discuss them. But really the key is how you put things into practice. And, you know, you can't keep it at arm's length. Like you need to hold it close to you, get dirty, and you don't know what's underneath there. It's really just about the process of finding out what's underneath the stone. How can we, what can we build with these materials? Because liberation is not an end result. It's the process, it's the struggle. So only through actually building a democratic society, fighting for a democratic society, only through that process can you really understand what liberation means. You never fully arrive at it. And you can't do this in sort of a sterile environment in a political bubble where everyone agrees, because it's really about, you know, resolving conflicts and finding ways to live with each other across all of society. So you can't just withdraw from the state or from society in order to do it. You need to really kind of engage with people and like really fight for democracy. Democracy is sort of like the ultimate trump card. And if you think about it a little bit, then this contradiction automatically emerges, right? So democracy is the bottom line, but then what about our other values? You know, women's liberation, anti-fascism, sustainability. So what if a group of people democratically decide that they don't want women's liberation or they don't want sustainability? How do we engage with that? Or they just want to elect a leader and go on with their lives. And this is something that's playing out in Rojava a lot. And as I mentioned before, there's some regions which organize more according to a tribal structure. And they say, well, we're just going to have our, you know, our headman, our sheikh, to be our representative. And we're not going to elect a women's co-chair, which is one of the basic principles in Rojava, that every leadership position is shared by a man and a woman. And so you do have this immediate contradiction of what is this sort of trump card? Is it democracy or is it women's liberation? Is it democracy or is it sustainability? Is it radical democracy? But this is the exactly how we develop a culture of democracy, by engaging in those issues. So a really interesting example of how this contradiction was met and engaged with by the movement in Rojava is that in these more sort of traditional patriarchal tribal groups who refused to bring a woman co-chair to the assemblies and the councils, And they say, okay, fine, we're not going to force you. Because if we were to force you to have this very superficial engagement with gender equality, then you wouldn't actually take it into yourself. You wouldn't change the way you think. We would be the same as the Assad regime and imposing things from the top down. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to invest in women's education. Our women's movement is going to engage with the wives of the tribal sheikhs in order to kind of develop those networks in the existing power structures. We're going to open up women's houses and women's centers within these spaces in order to actually let that region, let that area develop its own women's movement, which will eventually fight for the right for equal representation. And so, for example, the women's law, which forbids polygamy, was passed in 2014 by the three original cantons, Afrin, Kobani, and Jazeera. But it hasn't passed yet in any of the other four regions, which more recently have been liberated from ISIS, as recently as a year ago. So the movement is saying, well, for now, if we were to completely forbid polygamy, there'd be such a big backlash that we wouldn't actually be able to organize through these communities anymore. So instead, we're going to have to invest in this long-term perspective and sit with the contradiction of, by nurturing democracy, we will eventually reach women's liberation, but we can't impose it. But until we reach it, until we are closer to it, we have to just hold that tension. And we do that by having a really strong idea of what we believe in and a faith that it's the right thing. And it's something that we can achieve if we work together and we work with determination and commitment and this long-term perspective. And that for me is why it's really important that at the time of the corona crisis, we do take time to invest in political education and reflection, because by developing our sense of what our long-term perspective, what our vision for society is, only then can we strengthen our, you know, society, our communities, to the point that when the next crisis hits, we're in a better position to fight it and to respond to it than we are now. So the goal of democratic confederalism and of building up a movement for democratic society, as I mentioned, isn't to carve away these autonomous spaces, even though some autonomy and some autonomous spaces are really important to build your strength and your perspective and your education. For example, for the Kurdish freedom movement, the mountains have been this autonomous space, where the guerrilla go, where the mothers go, where the young people go in order to receive education and to live a more developed form of collective free life. But fundamentally, they need to go back into society in Bakur, Turkish Kurdistan, or in Northeast Syria, or into, you know, wherever they happen to be organizing. And so coming out of that, you then need to engage again in this sort of battlefield society. And that means you can't just be united against a common enemy, right? You have to have an idea of what you're building up and fighting for it. So the framework that we work in is that if we're kind of loosely taking this 99% framework, where 1% of the people in the world are the people who really build, reinforce, control, and benefit from capitalism and patriarchy and state fascism, then the 99% of us, society, communities, we're the ones who are exploited by it. So then if we think about how we organize, why do we take 99% of our energy and gear it towards this 1% who are in power, and we're always putting, you know, throwing ourselves against that enemy? Like, instead we should be putting more of our energy into building up society, building up our strength, and building up democratic culture in our communities in order to actually be able to, you know, provide the counter proposition to state, the counter proposition to patriarchy, and to develop something different. And a lot of this is done through education. It's a huge, I was really, really inspired in Rojava, just how much education there's going on. Everything from children, young women, older women, teachers, everybody has access to so many education opportunities, because, you know, in the refugee camps, they have academies where women can attend and learn both practical skills like sewing and literacy, but also learn about ideology and political analysis. So really every site is seen as a possibility for like building up this democratic mentality and democratic autonomy. And I'm running out of time now, so I'm gonna have to be quite brutal about what I talk about. But yes, so to echo a little bit something that Nick said around this dichotomy that we often have between sort of state-oriented politics, like lobbying or electoral politics, so say the Labour Party or NGOs, versus this more kind of like autonomous kind of anti-politics, which a lot more sort of radical activists would engage in, we aren't able to create a really broad, diverse, variable movement that can respond and can use tactics accordingly. So we kind of shape our politics and our political identity by the tactics we use and not actually about the kind of world that we're trying to build. And once again, the importance of this education and of nurturing this democratic society is that if you really know where you're coming from and you have that strength of understanding of what you're fighting for, then you're so much more able to hold tensions of working with people you disagree with or working within a system that you disagree with, like electoral politics or lobbying. Otherwise, just default into having your politics as an identity that needs to be constantly reaffirmed by the people around you, instead of being able to go to a place where lots of people disagree with you and be able to hold those tensions and hold those contradictions. And I think the question that raises for me then is like, well, whose job is it to make democratic society? And it fundamentally is each one of ours. You know, whenever we go into, whether it's a Labour Party meeting or a blockade or a protest camp or a mutual aid group, we bring our politics and perspective with us, and it's our job to with love and respect and comradeship communicate that and, you know, work on our powers of persuasion in order to like really say like, I believe this for a reason, and I think that this is necessary in order to build a better world, in order to build a democratic world where people aren't exploited by, you know, the state, by corporations, where actually we can put humans and humanity at the center of how we organize our communities, how we organize our society. And it's a long process, all of this. And I think something that a friend in Rojava said that really stuck with me was that in Rojava, after the revolution, we did more revolution. The revolution never stops, and actually the sort of military aspect of the Rojava revolution in some ways was one of the easiest aspects, but actually going into society and encouraging people to develop a different kind of mentality and to take ownership of their lives, and instead of wanting their neighborhood commune co-chair to just sort out their problems and give them their subsidized bread and their subsidized diesel, to actually participate that into that as a democratic organ, as a place where they can take ownership of their society and take part in the self-defense and education and building up of their community. So in order to just give a bit more of a practical example of what this looks like on a big picture, before I sign off, I wanted to kind of sketch out a little bit about how these ideas of having different tactics and abilities and contradictions, what kind of bigger picture political system can this actually create? You know, how has it developed in Rojava? So with the new paradigm that was developed in the 90s and the noughties by the Kurdish freedom movement, it was really acknowledging, as well as the sort of recognition of the failure of state communism, it also acknowledged that an exclusive focus on militant armed guerrilla struggle was not enough to create a revolutionary democratic society. So instead, like, you do need to maintain the militant aspect of struggle, but you also need a mass civil resistance based on grassroots democracy. And you also need some level of engagement with the, you know, political systems, you know, through lobbying or electoral politics. And you see now that the Kurdish freedom movement in Turkish Kurdistan do engage in politics, in electoral politics, but only as one aspect of their broader organizing. So in Rojava, the whole political system is made up of several bigger bodies. So one is the autonomous administration, which I already mentioned, so which has the communes, which federate into neighborhoods, districts, regions, and then all of North and East Syria. And right now, for example, the communes, just like our mutual aid groups, are organizing local food deliveries in order to, you know, support people during the corona crisis. So that's a really interesting parallel. So it's really about like how society works, the fabric of how we organize education, health, food, transportation, all of this stuff. It's all run through democratic assemblies and communes. Then you have another body, which is the Syrian Democratic Council, which is more of a diplomatic body that engages with other states, which engages with the Assad regime of the Syrian government, which will send representatives to US Congress or to the Italian parliament and so on. So that's the kind of more diplomatic, engaging with the state system, with the UN kind of wing. And then finally you have TevDem, which is called the Movement for Democratic Society. And that represents civil society, labor unions, professional associations, media associations. And then so that therefore nurtures the sort of grassroots, people organizing themselves in a much more kind of organic grassroots civil society sort of way. So this is, and this is all coming together, and all of these different organizations or institutions have representatives and communication with each other. Whereas it often feels like in the UK, like civil society and communities are quite cut out from government because government is the state. Whereas in Rojava, governance is something that all of these different bodies and all of the people take responsibility for. So hopefully that'll give you some idea of the perspectives that can be gained from how things work in Rojava and how things have been developing. If you have any questions, I'm sure we can talk about them in the discussion a bit more. And thank you for listening.